I'm going to do now. Before I do, please thank Rian and Peter for their opening. Panel, which is electricity prices, electricity market reform, new technology and renewables. A lot of subjects there, but we have the people to talk about them. We're talking about onto the platform. Patrick Herring, Chairman of Physical Commodity Markets Association. Angela Knight, Chief Executive of Energy UK. Mark Ripley is Director of UK Regulation of the National Grid. And Marcus Trini, QC, is a partner here at Evershed, specialising in energy policy. Marcus, let's have 5 minutes from each of you, kicking off with you, Marcus, and then we'll get a discussion going.
Sure.
Thank you, Andrew. Good afternoon, everybody. Is it working, this thing? Can you hear me at the
Yes,
back?
It is.
Good. I'm a projects person, not a policy person. I dairy farm on a project basis. I come up every so often, look around at the policy environment and wonder what happens since I last looked up. At that stage, I do two things. Well, one thing, I start asking daft laddie questions. Some of them really are genuinely stupid questions. Some of them make me realize two things. Firstly, there is no such thing as objective truth in energy policy. Truth is the first casualty of a discussion. Everyone has a position from which they come. It's very difficult to get to the truth. Secondly, that it's too complex an area for any one person to understand. And that leads to decisions being made on the basis of partial information, which is always a little bit dangerous. So I'm just going to start off with a historical review, because I've been treading the boards of public inquiries in God knows what since 1988 in renewables and full-time in this industry since 1990. And I've observed, certainly during the 80s and 90s, after privatization anyway, that in the, if you look at the three objectives of low price, low carbon, and security of supply, they don't change. That very much there was a low carbon emphasis, also a dash for gas in the 80s, but low carbon emphasis in the early 1990s. Low carbon was king, non-fossil fuel obligation and so forth. Then we had 1990s and 2000s, a gradual transition from the importance of low carbon to the importance of security of supply. That started to take hold. I guess that was so up until about 2010. And then from then on, we've had a dash for low price, which has supplanted to some extent security of supply, certainly supplanted the low carbon emphasis very considerably under the current government. And the relevance of what I say is that energy always was a long-term game. It's not something you can play out short-term. Well, you can play it if you get it wrong. It's properly a long-term game for investors. Investors can cope with change. That's fine. All governments must be able to change policy. We don't object to that. But it has to be well planned, well consulted upon, apparently logical. We mustn't ripple the water of the investment market too much. So we've seen the change from the non-fossil fuel obligation to ROCs in 2000. We saw ROCs change to the EMR, still are already, in the transition period. That's okay, the market can cope with that, it's been consulted upon, we can manage it. But, and I speak from the point of view of renewables because that's what I know about anything, what we can't cope with are short-term, politically inspired, unforeseeable changes of direction. That's difficult. And there has been a series of factors under the current government, a series of events, which have occurred, which have led to a reduction in investment confidence. And I get to exempt from anything I say our Energy Secretary of State, Ed Davey, who I think has been a brave man, a difficult position, and has done a very good job. What are these factors or events? Well, I list five. First is an event that maybe David Cameron unwisely signed up to as part of the coalition government, that's fixed term elections. The election started 2 years ago. That makes investment the investment market more difficult of itself. Secondly, there's the visceral fear by the Conservatives of UKIP, which is driving a lot of what is happening on onshore wind at a local level. Thirdly, Ed Miliband's, was it wise, wasn't it, not for me to say, energy price pronouncement at the second last party conference, I think it was. Fourthly, the backing away from proper price support for offshore wind, which has ravaged that industry, there's no other word for it. I work in it, I see what happens, I see the projects dropping away, I see the prognostications of 15 gigawatts come down to 10, come down to 8, where are we now, 6 maybe, by 2020. That's a very big hit taken in the short term. And I see things like the vacillations about solar, support for solar, through the lifetime of one government, several changes of mind, has not helped. Now, up till recently, I think the UK has been protected from the consequences of vacillation and changes, because just as capital can always go anywhere, it has to go somewhere. And the UK is inherently a stable regulatory platform, a stable investment market, compared with lots of other countries. But I have a feeling, when I occasionally come up for air for my projects, that is changing. The perception of the UK as a stable investment regulatory platform is changing, and some of what we heard today has underpinned what I think. And maybe there are two factors that I've seen which have driven that home. There's firstly the realization that under CFD there just isn't going to be enough available within the levy control framework to fund what needs to be funded and built by 2020. There isn't enough there. And secondly, the death threats uttered by Mr. Pickles, Mr. Paterson, Mr. Everybody to onshore wind hasn't helped at all. So, from a renewable energy perspective, I've been destructive in my criticism. It's up to me to make some suggestions, I guess, is what we do to put it right, otherwise I haven't really helped anybody. I think from an onshore wind point of view, again, I can only speak from renewables, I don't know about oil and gas, a lot about them. First of all, I deny it's expensive. It's not expensive. At £85 a megawatt hour, I think you will see, no, I know you will see, over the next 2 or 3 years, quite a lot of private wire connections, sleeving to end users in the UK at the brand power price, with end users paying whatever premium they will pay in order to guarantee, get some hold on their own energy prices, i.e. without CFD. It can be done, it will be done, and I'm sure solar will follow with that. PV, I'm not quite so sure, I don't know it. Secondly, I think we simply have to persuade politicians after the current brutal general election, before which nothing will happen, of the need to have a balance between the three overall objectives. It's no good swinging like a pendulum from low price to low carbon to security, that there must be a proper balance struck and maintained. That's a naive point. I know it is. I'm being deliberately naive. Okay, I'm allowed to be. I'm not a politician. Thirdly, even more naive, is putting politics back in the box. Energy is too important. It needs to be thought about too long term to lead to the vacillations, especially of a fixed term parliament. We need some stability in energy policy, otherwise nothing will happen. I think, finally, let me just put out a challenge. No, fourthly, to be really brave, our newspapers don't help. I think we have a higher proportion of foreign-owned newspapers than any other country in Europe. That may or may not be the reason that the Daily Telegraph and others don't seem to care about the facts when they print what they print about renewables, or not terribly anyway. I give some examples that called upon us to have the and finally, on shale gas, I'm not a believer when it comes to energy. I actually do want the objective truth. And what I haven't heard from anybody yet, please somebody tell me and persuade me, because I'm persuadable, is how much is the right there in the UK? And for how long will it last? If someone persuades me that the game is worth the candle, I will support the game. But I haven't heard the facts yet. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marcus. since it's our sister publication, I should point out the Telegraph is not foreign owned. It's British owned. But other than that, it was factually correct. Let's hear now from the Chief Executive of Energy UK, Angela Knight. Okay.
Do you want me to go up
Yes,
there,
please, for there, and then we'll continue the discussion.
Well, thank you. In some respects, I'm going to be extremely brief because I came in, what, about two-thirds, halfway through the previous presentation. And I do agree with a lot of that which Peter Atherton had to say. We are dealing with energy policy, which has been crafted in bits, and I think in part because when it was considered, it was never properly thought through. An industry perspective tends to look at what happens in the generation side without thinking through policy as it impacts the customer. But in the end, it's the customer who has to pay, whether it is the retail customer or whether it is the business customer. I think it's just been said by Marcus that the trilemma of affordability, of decarbonisation, of security of supply has to have a priority. And I would agree with that, because if one considers what they mean to people, affordability, well, the whole of the public have been told that they're paying too much right now for their energy. So if you're paying too much right now for your energy, how do we do the however many billions of investment that is needed to move from the generation mixture that we've got at the moment to a new one? I mean, it is a rhetorical question. The answer is, actually, it's very difficult to do so. Second aspect on security of supply. I entirely agree with what's been said earlier, and I'm sure that Mark's going to give us more information on that, that security of supply, A, is vital, B, capacity is reducing, but C, the lights aren't going to go out. At the same time, there's no relaxation that can take place. Because measures, whether they're taken right now as interim measures or whether they are long-term measures in order to ensure that the sufficient capacity is there, they all are going to cost money. And on the decarbonisation route, well, we are certainly building a significant amount of renewables in this country. I've got an app on my iPad which I was just looking at. And at the moment, we're pulling about 43-44 gigawatts of power. If you look to see where that power is coming from, it's more or less 80% is split evenly between gas and coal-fired power stations. And then if you look to see what's coming off our renewables, off our wind, the answer is about 1.3-1.4 gigawatts. We've got nearly 12 gigawatts installed. It's a cold day out there. The sun isn't shining. The wind's not blowing. And we do need to still be sure that we can turn on, when we flick our switches, the lights come on. And of course, the perhaps even more fundamental requirement of British industry has got the electricity that it needs. So none of this can be done cheaply. Now, from the supplier's perspective, and suppliers are a vital part of the Energy UK membership, just as the generators are, from the supplier's perspective, more or less, anything that they say is never going to be believed. Part of that is because clearly they have a vested interest, but another part is because there's been very legitimate complaints about customer service for a number of years. I can argue that the customer service is improving. At the same time, societal expectations are also increasing. And so that close affinity that there needs to be between supplier and customer in order to generate trust and confidence has got a long way to go to be restored. Amongst the many things we do at Energy UK is we use some of the varying polling organisations to get into some of the issues at some depth. And so I thought I'd bring with me just a couple of examples. First of all, on customer experience, the trust area, if you like. There, as one drills down through trust, what you do find is that the consumer really does not like energy prices. That's absolutely in the no camp. But in a lot of other areas, interestingly, the confidence that the customer has in the supplier is well above 50%. Now, you might say it needs to be better. I would agree, but it is well above 50%. So am I going to get my gas and electricity? Well, they score pretty highly on that. Do they answer the telephone? Will they deal with me in a polite manner? They score, interestingly, quite reasonably on that as well. So you can draw some conclusions. Firstly, as we've been able to do some trends, that some of those areas are improving. But secondly, that still standing in front of us all is the question of how much people are prepared to pay for their gas and electricity. Now, some of the other polls that we've done, we polled the members of parliament. We actually polled the members of parliament now three times. We don't do it as Energy UK. One of the polling companies has a panel of about 150 MPs, and they're given literally dozens of questions on a quarterly basis. And then the answers to the questions are grossed up in order to reflect the views of parliament. So on the questions of where do you put your priorities, more or less, Parliament has right at the top of the list affordability. Why I say more or less is that just depending on when you poll depends whether security of supply beats affordability. But those two are right up there. And there's a very big gap before one gets to the whole question of meeting our carbon targets. So although it's not out there as decisions by ministers, it is clear that amongst the parliamentary constituency, there are some real concerns. We've also had polling done of people and indeed of Parliament as to what their views are on various aspects of renewables. Now, people are actually committed to the low-carbon, renewable, clean-up route. What they're not prepared to do is pay for it. So the conundrum is very much in front of us. And I accept entirely that there's a very significant role that the industry has to play. At the same time, it has a role to play within a current framework which seems to be increasingly out of tempo with the population of this country. So either the policymakers have got to sell their policy to the country, all the policymakers will ultimately have to change their policy. At the moment, we're just in a no man's land. As has been said, the run up to the general election has created that. Post the general election, the need for investment is high. If we're going to implement EMR, that is very significant costs. Decisions will have to be made. Thank you.
Angela, thank you for that. Let's move right along to our third speaker, the chairman of the Physical Commodity Markets Association. Please welcome Patrick Herron. Patrick, you can do it from there.
I'd rather stand, actually.
Okay.
Can't see them at the back. Sitting down.
Quite the eyes.
Quite right.
Thank you very much. Vladimir Lenin famously said that communism was Soviet power plus the electrification of the entire, of the whole country. And I think that reflects, well, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's for Russia. But I think that certainly reflects the importance. It is important that the government keeps the lights on, keeps prices down, and therefore energy is a vital concern for government. But if I go back to the beginning of my career as a extremely humble price reporter in 1976, an oil market price reporter, in those days OPEC affected to control the oil price by regular diktats. Every 6 months or so, they would put the price up by another 50 cents a barrel or whatever it might be. And that for some years throughout the 1970s and into the early 1980s, that did set the oil price. The reason I mention it is because the British government has twice in my career, through enlightened I think an enlightened withdrawal, if you like, from market intervention, decisively affected energy prices, not only in this country, but in the world. The first one, the one that undercut OPEC, and is, to my astonishment, still not regularly, not properly understood, I think, is the development of the Brent market,
yes.
The Brent crude oil market, in the late 70s and early 1980s, which enabled a non-OPEC-controlled crude oil stream from the North Sea to become the benchmark that it still is today, even though the crude oil stream is much changed. And that was done through essentially UK tax policy, which encouraged the development of that market. We fast forward then, though under the same government, a few years, the privatization, the liberalization, the unwinding of the, in retrospect, when you look at it, the extraordinary energy complex we had in this country in, say, in 1979, when Mrs. Thatcher's government came to power, the Central Electricity Generating Board, the National Coal Board, the Atomic Energy Authority, the huge influence of the National Union of Mine Workers, an intensely sort of politicized, sclerotic, high-cost, basically state control of British energy. By privatizing British gas and later the electricity supply industry, we produced in this country a remarkably competitive open market, which throughout, particularly through the course of the 1990s, cut our energy costs in this country to the lowest, pretty well the lowest in the European Union. They also, nobody for some reason, not even the government seemed to want to take credit for this, they also made us the only Kyoto Protocol signatory which actually met its CO2 reduction targets in that period. So it was a great success, two great successes for a government which is prepared to actually withdraw from hands-on attempted control of energy markets. But with success, of course, comes amnesia. So by the last decade, the political class in this country had more or less forgotten this narrative. And I was very struck in 2007. There was a white paper was published by the government under a now largely forgotten energy minister called Lord Truscott, who later got into trouble for other matters. It was the first of the great green narratives that were pushed by the government. And I was reading it leafing through it at the launch, and looking for something about what was actually going to keep the lights on in this decade, the decade we're in now, when the received wisdom in the British energy industry or the European energy industry was, of course, that companies, the E.ONs, the RWEs, the Centricas, etc., would build a new generation of combined cycle gas turbines to keep the lights on. There was nothing about this, as far as I could see, in the white paper. I asked a question of Lord Truscott, who got suggested that gas was the fuel that dare not speak its name, and he got rather cross with me about that. But afterwards, I spoke to two of the civil servants who drafted the document, and they were like rather naughty schoolboys. They said, "Well, actually, if you look at the footnote on page 38, you'll see that we recognise there that." That gas is what will keep the lights on in the next decade. As we know, since then the Climate Change Act. We had the whole panoply of powers that were brought in, and the extension of the subsidy regime for renewables, and last year I think the Energy Act, which brought in the much heralded electricity market reform. And essentially, as a senior civil servant said to me last year, the only thing you have to understand about the Energy Act is not the particular elements of it, but that it enables the Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change to intervene in pretty well any way he likes in the energy market. And I think that is the situation we now find ourselves in, for good or ill. I'm not here to debate the merits of decarbonisation. I just think this is not a very effective way of decarbonising, while also keeping prices down. I think it's rather extraordinary that we now have, although we have a government which is largely Tory, we are now the most energy dirigiste country in Europe. Though unlike the French, who are rather more successful in dealing with their with their nuclear industry, we, as Peter said earlier, are ending up with the most expensive nuclear power plant in the world. Just to conclude, I think the 2015 next year we have what is obviously going to be an extraordinary election, and who knows what will come out after it. But I think if the government that emerges wants to keep the lights on, wants to keep prices down, I think it's time to rethink the subsidy regime, withdraw from the kind of dirigism we've had in the last few years, and above all, actually, encourage the development of shale gas. Thank you.
Thanks, Patrick. And before we move to the Q&A, let's hear from the Director of UK Regulation of National Grid, Mark Ridley.
Thank you. Timely indeed, as we come into the winter and the general election next year, as has been mentioned on a number of occasions. So I'm going to talk a little bit about EMR, because as you know, we have everybody's EMR. That's a little bit further ahead in terms of it coming to fruition. And now I'll talk a little bit about this winter, which has been touched on a few times already. So in terms of EMR, we're actually supportive of the measures we've put in place. CFD is a good way to incentivise low carbon generation. It enables low carbon generation to be a merit, and it can bid at a price that will get itself away. So you can get low carbon generation that's available, which is good for your renewable targets, but also the generator can have their top up and ensure they can make their revenue stream. But it also protects us as consumers. So if in the event the wholesale price rise is high, it hedges us as consumers, which I think is a good thing. The capacity market. So much debate in the early days of EMR about whether we should or shouldn't have a capacity market. We've had both models in GB. Under the pool we had capacity payments, and since NITA and BETA, we've had a single price market. I think the world has changed a little bit from NITA and BETA. Firstly, we have low carbon generation. As I say, that's incentivized to run if it can run. We have people describe it as a cliff edge, accidents of history. Plant has reached the end of its life in terms of some of the nuclear plants in the next few years, some of the other gas plants. Economics have been challenging. We've seen some coal plant that has opted out of LCBT run out of its hours more quickly than you might have imagined because of coal prices. So you've had this reduction in capacity which has precipitated a need for quite a bit of investment. And the capacity market, I think, allows people to do that. It provides them with a stable revenue stream which protects them, and the consumer is effectively saying, I'm going to pay this price as a hedge, I can be sure the capacity will be there, and on the days I need it, I won't pay outrageous scarcity rents as you might do under a single price model. So, I think there's some logic to the capacity market. It feels like a good intervention for us, and I think it has the potential to maintain security of supply. So what's our role in EMR to everybody? Well, what I would stress at the outset is we are not a policy setting beast. We are a humble private company, and policy decisions are decisions for government. We do two, three things in EMR. Firstly, we do economic analysis and modelling to help inform the government. Second, we check people's eligibility for contracts. Thirdly, we allocate contracts, things that we do now as the system operator. So the modelling relates to strike prices. So we look at how we think generation will open or close at different strike prices. We model the system out to 2030, and we give government information about what we think will happen in that space, and then they make decisions about how much they want or don't want and set the prices accordingly. For capacity, we take the government's reliability standard, 3 hours loss of load expectation. We have a view about what the low carbon rollout will be, and from that we can work out against different demand scenarios what level of capacity you might need. And then we stress test that against a number of sensitivities. Sensitivities such as low plant availability, to take account of events that we've seen recently with plant falling over at short notice, to take account of low wind, to take account of exports and interconnectors. So we do look at a range of credible scenarios under which the system will be stressed to work out what we think we need to maintain that 3 hours loss of load expectation. So lots being done on EMR. We finished the pre-qualification in the August. We were in the first auction for capacity on the 16th of January with results just over the Christmas period or beyond. But that's dealing with winter 18-19, which is 4 years away. And as has been noted, the next winter and the winter after that are seen as relatively tight on margins. We've seen tighter, but energy is very much in the public eye, so this is rightly getting a lot of attention and focus. So we work closely with Ofgem and the government to develop TU balancing services. Balancing services are the tools we have today as a system operator to balance the system. And what are we trying to access here? Well, we're not going to build anything new by this winter or the following winter unless it's already being built. So we're about, can you reduce people's demand? We have a demand side response, which I stress is voluntary. And can we access plant that would otherwise not be participating in the market, which is our strategic balancing reserve? Some people know that as a strategic reserve in other markets. And we've contracted both of those products for this winter. We're in the process of tendering for the following winter. And therefore, with those volumes, we believe that we will be able to maintain secure supply against the government standard against some pretty extreme scenarios. You know, we are vigilant. We have people running system tests all the time, making sure that we have the arrangements in place and the system set up to maximise flows of power. And we will continue to develop our capabilities in things like wind forecasting and others so that we can have the best view of the future. So not complacent, but there's a lot going on, both through EMR and through the work we're doing now to meet those needs of decarbonisation, secure energy supplies.
Great. Thank you for that, Mark.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Mark, for that. Right, just to remind you, the title of this panel was Energy Prices, Electricity Market Reform, New Technology and Renewables. So let's move on to that. And let me ask each of you, if you can answer the question, don't, just let me know. But let's begin with energy prices. Is it the panel's view that energy prices for household and domestic users, for household and industrial users in this country, will rise through the rest of this decade, Marcus?
I see no scenario where they won't.
Explain.
What I mean is that there's the balance to be struck between low carbon security of supply and price is a balance that inevitably has to be struck somehow. You have to, any government has to secure supplies of energy domestically. Any government, I hope, cannot totally ignore the environmental agenda. And you can't have all three together, and therefore price will go up to some extent. That is what I mean.
All right. Angela.
Well, if it's gas you're talking about, gas will tend to go with whatever's happening in the wholesale market around the world. And it's gas price that actually is usually most important for domestic consumers, because we heat our houses with gas central heating, and therefore that ends up at something, I don't know, 60%+ of the bill. If you're talking about electricity, well then that's different. The electricity is undoubtedly going to increase, because the predominant costs of all interventions, you know, even whether it's insulating houses, which doesn't help you on electricity but helps you on your gas, just about all of the interventions actually sit directly on your electricity bill. And it's one of the reasons why industry is legitimately very concerned, because industry uses about 70% of electricity. We should actually sometimes differentiate our gas and our electricity policies. And of course, if you go back to see what it is that DEC have actually said about the policy costs sitting on the electricity bill, they are rising very significantly indeed. So electricity, yes, gas, it'll depend what's happening in the world.
Patrick.
Yeah, I agree with what Angela just said, but just to add to that, one of the great foolishnesses of the current government and its policy on this sort of thing, and particularly the way it's supported by the so-called Committee on Climate Change, one of those wonderful bodies of august chaps who know the right answer that they're expected to give, is that the idea that hydrocarbon prices, global hydrocarbon prices, are going to keep on rising, whereas of course they're not, and that they're shrinking, and that the argument being, of course, that rising hydrocarbon prices would eventually make the subsidised renewables attractive. Whereas the reverse is happening.
Sure. But I'm just trying to get an answer to a simple question here.
Yeah, I'm trying.
Will energy prices for industrial and domestic users rise through the rest of this decade?
Well, it's a mix. The answer is yes and no. Some will and some won't, and it depends.
Which will the domestic electricity
prices in particular,
which is what Angela was saying.
Yeah. But if you're only exposed to the gas price, obviously then that's different. So the overall balanced picture may be that people feel in 5 years' time slightly more comfortable. But on the other hand, I'm not like the Committee on Climate Change or DEC. I don't pretend that I can predict the oil price or the gas price in 5 years' time.
Okay. So, Mark Reed.
The risk of agreeing with everyone. I'm not very good at predicting gas and oil prices in 5 years' time. If I was, I'd be doing a different job. But it's true, Angela says, about the use of energy in this country. In 2020, I think 40% of our energy is from gas, a large proportion from oil, and a relatively small proportion of electricity. So yeah, that will be dictated by the global market. I think I'd agree with other panelists, and electricity will tend to increase. You look at the nature of the prices being paid for CFDs. Although what I would say is that we're already seeing some downward pressure on those prices as technologies get more mature.
Okay. Electricity market reform, which we're going to do more in our final session today. But what is the single change in our electricity market that would make a big improvement to how it operates? Angela.
I wish I had the answer, because if I had, I'd have started off by telling government and politicians rather than this audience. But I do think that there's some things which clearly do really warrant looking at. The first is, why don't we go for the most cost-effective route for decarbonisation? That's number one. Number two is, why don't we link the closure programmes and the opening programmes together? I know of no business who would say, I've got X number of customers, and I'm going to close that factory over there, and then I'm going to think about opening that new factory. So our closure and our opening programs are disconnected. I think if they put that together, that would certainly help. There's a whole chunk of stuff within the retail area.
All right,
important.
I just asked for one.
Yeah, so I beg your pardon.
Give me more
there
than
we
one.
Go. Sorry.
Marcus.
It's the levy control framework that worries me, and I think it's going to unnecessarily inhibit the growth of technologies such as offshore wind, which I believe we will need.
Okay, Mark?
So I'm not sure I entirely agree with Angela when she says the Secretary of State can just about change anything under the Energy Act, but there are certainly capabilities in there. I think stability is what would be really important. We've got electricity market reform. Let's run with it, let's not meddle with it, let's let it deliver its the investment it's intended to.
So no change?
I don't think major change is needed.
All right, Patrick.
I think the idea that I've always fancied is breaking the vertical integration in generation, so that generators would have to flog all of their electricity output on the market every
month. So you separate supplier and generator?
Absolutely.
All right, thank you for that. New technology. What's the one breakthrough in new technology that could be a game changer in the next 10 years? Mark?
I think we're going to go first on that one, to be honest.
Too late. Well, you're involved in a lot of smart grids and so on these days, aren't you?
We are, yes. I mean, I think, you know, there is something in that. You know, if you look at the some of the charts that have been put up for EMR, which show that firstly you decarbonize electricity and then you electrify energy as you go out to 2050. You know, clearly there is a risk that as you start to electrify heat and perhaps electrify vehicles, you bring an ever increasing tea time peak. So you make the capacity situation even more significant. So, you know, I think, you know, something that we will need to do over the next, you know, 10 to 15 years is have much more sophisticated, you know, care of demand, both in terms of demand shifting, demand management, and energy efficiency. We talked about, you know, insulation of houses earlier. So as we do electrify energy, we can mitigate some of that sort of stacking, if you like, at the two-time peak.
Okay, Patrick.
I have no idea, but electricity storage, I think that would be.
Yeah.
What else? Angela.
I think the generality is finance the technology to get it to the condition for putting in the market first, rather than putting it in the market and then, you know, finance it to see what happens. I think we do it, you know, reverse around. But I'm with electricity storage, actually, things like, you know, fuel cells, because it comes, electricity, it comes in a lot of things. And I think we talk about fuel cells. For all I know, it's time has come. So let's get investing in some of those things.
All right. Marcus.
Electricity storage for the same reasons as Angela. Smooth out the differences between load for base load and intermittencies. Maybe even, but I'm talking ignorantly, it's only a guess, in the long term, reduce the need for new generation.
Okay. And finally, renewables. At the moment, our intention is to depend, as renewables become a larger part of our electricity generation, most of that money is going into wind, both offshore and onshore. Is that right? Is that the correct way ahead with renewables? Patrick?
No, because they're inefficient and unreliable.
Angela?
No, for the same reasons.
Mark?
I think wind does have a contribution to make. You know, we value a diverse range of energy supplies. Wind is has an abundance.
Are we right to make it the locus of our renewable strategy?
It's right for it to be part of the policy.
That's different.
And, you know, as I said before, I'm not a policy maker. What I would add, though, and the point about its unreliability, and people talk to us about being able to manage wind, whilst wind, you know, cannot be guaranteed to blow, it is becoming much more predictable. Forecasting techniques are improving dramatically, so, you know, we are able to manage wind in a way that we historically wouldn't have been able to, so that's something we are able to do in the future.
All right.
Can I make a
Marcus.
Point on that?
Hold on, I'm going to let Marcus have a say.
I don't think it's an over-concentration on wind. Other technologies since 1988 have had a chance to come forward. Biomass, wave and tidal. Why haven't they? Someone tell me. Wind has come forward, and coupled with interconnectors to smooth out load demand across Europe, I see no reason why it shouldn't play an increasingly valuable role.
You think that interconnectors alone can smooth out the demand?
No, I think you need electricity storage as well.
But in the absence of that, since we don't have that yet.
Well, I've yet to see any figures that tell me that intermittency, and I'm sitting next to National Grid, so they'll tell me if I'm wrong, do actually cause a problem on the network.
Right, but I would suggest that's because at the moment we still have massive gas and coal-fired and nuclear capability.
We do, but as I said, we have invested tremendous amounts in improving our forecasting of wind. So it becomes, whilst not as reliable in terms of you can guarantee it will run, it becomes much more predictable.
So do we know how much wind will generate tomorrow?
We'll have a pretty good view of it, yes.
Yeah,
I haven't got the figure. I haven't got your app.
Can you find out?
I could find, well.
I can tell you what it's generating now.
No, at the moment it's generating about
1.4 gigawatts. Yeah.
Gigawatts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is 3% of our electricity
correct.
Needs at the moment.
It was 3.1 in the last half hour.
3.1
in Cumbria. You're all very well connected.
Yeah. And we've got 12 gigawatts in the system.
Yeah, just a brief anecdote that one of my pre-retirement job lists that I have at the moment is being something called the External Governance Advisor to the Crown Commercial Services Energy Procurement Business. And that's the central government's own energy procurement, which is quite a lot. It's about 2 billion quid a year. And CCS have come under pressure from further up the food chain to go into long-term power purchase agreements with new renewable generators. So we can't do it with gas-fired generators or anybody else, or even with Hinkley Point, but we can do it with renewables. And we've only got one in place, and that's with an anaerobic digestion plant up on Teesside for about 40 megawatts, which at a reasonable price, about 50, I'm not so much to say, but a reasonable price. But that is a
it's more or less, it's a lot cheaper than wind.
It's a lot cheaper than wind, and it's more or less, base load, so it runs at 80%. Right. We're under pressure to do it with wind, but the CCS, refuse to do it because it's just, we cannot guarantee. It would be too expensive to work it into our overall procurement and supply management.
Okay, package. You said it was going to be a short answer.
Yeah, sorry.
Right, some questions from the audience. Yes, lady there, give your hand up. Let's see another hand. And then the gentleman behind. Yes, lady there.
Thank you, Sheila Wren from the John Muir Trust. And just picking up on the point that Marcus made about putting politics back in the box. Sorry, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, if you just keep it a little bit away, you'll be fine.
Into
a little bit further down. Put your hand. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
My question is there any way that we can help governments become better at strategic long-term planning? Is it about time that we had something like Standing Energy Commission to advise government on that, to try and do away with some of the short-term fixes that we now face?
Can we be realistic here, Paolo? Given the importance of energy to people's lives and industry, you never take politics out of it, will you, Andrew?
No.
No?
No, I don't think you ever can. Because even if you try to take politics out of it by putting in place some third-party committee, however good they may be and however genuine their output, if something goes wrong, people turn around to the politician and say, hang on, you need to have got that right. The politician says, it's this third party down the road. They'll say, don't care about the third party down the road. You're supposed to be there. So politics will always be involved. I think the real problem is when political consensus breaks down. I think that's our real issue.
Is the Committee on Climate Change an attempt to do that to some extent? And when they attempt to have a kind of commission on energy, particularly on that area?
Yes.
But nobody blames Lord Devon when it goes wrong. They blame the politicians. Correct?
Well, that's absolutely correct. I'm not quite sure which one of us you're asking.
It's
absolutely correct. Yeah.
One thing Lord Devon said a couple of last year to me was that that he wished that when they were trying to make these important decisions about decarbonising the economy 5 or 6 years ago, that the industry had spoken up.
Oh, absolutely.
Because he said,
right.
He said, actually, we're just politicians. We're a bit in the dark.
Okay. Yes. Gentlemen there.
From the time that wind can break even at £80 a megawatt hour, surely wind farmers no longer need their public subsidies.
Okay, Marcus?
Not all wind can, some can. Yeah. That which can is increasing in quantity. And I'm saying what I'm saying based on conversations with my own generator clients.
But
not just my idea.
One of your first remarks was to deny that wind was expensive. Mm-hmm. And you then quoted a figure of £85 per megawatt hour. Well, that's between £35 and £40 higher than the market price at the moment. So why is that not expensive?
Well, you have to compare it with what else is out there. On a like-for-like basis, nuclear power at 35 years may be at £99, but I can tell you 15 years is about 170.
What about gas?
Well, gas is clearly cheaper than
what about coal?
No, I wouldn't say coal necessarily was. It depends how. It also depends whether your life's doing the costing on a full life cycle basis, including decommissioning.
We haven't done that for wind either yet.
Well, that has been done. In fact, wind farms do have to decommission themselves, especially offshore. You have to guarantee that before you can build them.
Yes, but the price of 85 megawatts per hour does not include the life cycle in it. That's the current rate which is generating electricity.
That is correct, yes. The more precise answer would be, of course, gas is cheaper, but I'm comparing onshore wind with the other new technologies. And just continuing, at offshore wind is at 155. I don't know what solar is, but it's certainly more expensive than onshore wind at present. Than onshore wind
but
at present.
Probably not offshore.
No, it's cheaper than offshore wind by far.
Okay, some more questions? Yes, gentleman there in the blue shirt. We got a mic to you.
So a lot of interest in storage as a technology, and the only storage mechanism that I'm familiar with right now is pumped hydro, right?
So can you say that again? Is
pumped hydro, where you pump the water up to a height, and then later when you need the power, you gotta come back down through the turbines and generate the power.
Yeah.
Would it be prudent that a policy for intermittent supplies, be it wind, whatever it might be, should have a mandatory quantity of pumped hydro in the project when it gets to go ahead?
That's an interesting
question.
Mark, what do you think of that?
So, yeah, this is effectively a question about can you secure that you give me your customers' demands by having some sort of backup technology. And, you know, all generators are to some extent in that position. Things happen, that's what we have. An imbalance arrangement and cash out prices are people out of balance. You know, for me, that's the way you incentivize people to decide whether they want to make their own facilities available or hedge with other people or trade in the market. So, you know, imbalance drives you to meet your position. You know, that is one way you could do it. I suspect you'd have to have some kind of aggregation because of the capital cost of the hydro scheme, but, you know, the incentives in the regime are supposed to drive that.
Okay.
Well, would it not more directly cost it into the project?
That's a good point.
Right, so rather than being able to come up with a figure of X per megawatt hour, which is purely the generation cost, it's ignoring the intermittency.
Could you do that with wind with existing technology?
If you have the pumped hydro, you can do it with any power.
Oh, I see. You use the wind to produce the pumped hydro.
Correct.
And then you've got that energy stored, yeah, as you have with hydro programs at the moment. But wouldn't that also, I mean, that would partly depend where the wind is as well. Not everywhere can have pumped.
Electricity moves pretty fast around the wires. It's not like gas where if it comes in St. Fergus, it's going to take 2-3 days for it to get down to London. But, you know, again, this sort of comes back to the point I made earlier about sort of sensible demand matching. You know, if the wind is blowing overnight in the summer, demand is very, very low. You know, actually pumping water up here would be a very good use of that power at that time, and therefore you can use your renewable capability without being out of balance. But that's a commercial decision people can take.
And are you saying that the pumped hydro, which is produced in this scenario by wind, wouldn't have to be beside the wind? You could send it down the line to the Lake District or the Highlands or wherever?
Not necessarily. You know, as I say, electrons move at the speed of light around the system, so you know, in that respect, they're perfectly capable of doing so. Now, that gets into debate about constraints, which people have heard a lot about wind. You know, the grid is not infinitely large. It would be very expensive to make it infinitely large. There is a sort of inherent efficient level of constraint in there, and we manage that as a system operator.
Okay. Marcus, you want to say a word about that?
I think pumped hydro, I get your point as a principle.
It's an interesting idea.
And I see the principle, and I'm not sure I disagree with it necessarily. But I think pumped hydro is a bad example, because that really is a specialist form of production to meet very peak hours. There may be other forms of base load that you can mix with wind. That, of course, is done anyway through the supply baskets of licensed suppliers. There are, in particular, some private licensed suppliers who match that basket every day.
All right, let me have another question from the front. We don't need the mic, just here. I'll bring you the mic here. Multi-skilling.
Thank you. I wanted to ask Patrick a question, but very quickly, Marcus.
The only way to know what the shale reserves are in this country is to allow somebody to drill for them. And if you successfully stop any exploration wells, you will very successfully prevent the knowledge of your question. Patrick, I wanted to ask you a question about the distortion of markets. You mentioned the very successful creation of the gas market and the electricity market in this country. And when you create such a successful market and then create a vast amount of generation which can bid in zero, surely that has a that almost undermines all of your or most of your gains from having that market in the first place. Shouldn't they have to bid something rather than always being able to bid zero?
Okay,
thank you.
Is that Patrick?
Yes, I agree they should. It is a distortion of the market, and I agree that they should be able to.
So that's another market reform we can chalk up to the Spectator Conference. Excellent. On that positive note, we'll go for our coffee break and give you a chance to network. The panel will be around, I'm sure. They can ask some questions, and we'll be back at 3:30 when we'll look at fracking, nuclear gas, all three or none of the above. But a round of applause for our panel, please. Thank you.
Part of the time, but it's not, but it's owned run by anybody. There's their son who lives in London and is educated in London.
Am I right?
There are plenty of other examples.
The producer of the gas consumers tax.
Oh, that's all right. We do all the time.
Nothing to do with the reform. No, Energy UK is a trade association brought together from the.
Are you the former major energy users?
No.
Something different.
Energy retailers, UK Business Council Sustainable Energy, and the Association of Electricity Producers. And then there was a comms group called Energy UK. So we brought a whole lot together. I was happy to bring everybody out. So it's kind of got everybody sitting in that.
It's not just the producers.
Oh,
I must
absolutely.
Say, after that first panel, why you ever attempted to do this? Are you there?
I came in and I thought, yes.